For the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people, we say sorry.
The past is the past, and no matter how hard we try, we cannot change that history. But let's start to undo the wrongs with what is right and just.
Today on RN Drive, we're continuing our series on Indigenous Australians called Behind the Gap.
Well, the thing is, the gap is beginning to close very slowly, and it's really important that people are committed to staying the course.
In many communities, police regard violence in Aboriginal communities as, quote, quote, it's just blackfellas again.
We want leaders who will convince our people to stop drinking, fighting, feuding, and who will get our kids to school.
The Closing the Gap statement is important because it forces us to stay committed.
Over the last few weeks, we've been delving behind the headlines and exploring some of the reasons behind the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. We've looked at the Closing the Gap report and constitutional recognition. Today we're going to look at why the jobs gap is increasing, despite attempts to curb unemployment. To give us an idea of some of the problems that need to be tackled, ABC Darwin reporter Alyssa Betts travelled to the remote community of Daly River, also known as Ngawiyu. One of the people Alyssa spoke to was 22-year-old Dion Mingan. Yeah.
Give it one more name, can you remember from underneath?
So let's cut to the chase. Do you have a job?
No, I don't have a job.
When did you finish high school?
Back in 2010.
Have you ever had a job since then?
Yeah, I did have a job.
Bits and pieces?
Yeah, bits and pieces. After that, nothing.
Mm-hmm. Is that a sort of common story for people your age in Ngawiyu?
Yeah, it is.
How does it make you feel about yourself when you don't have a job?
Makes you feel shit, really. Mm-hmm. Not to be able to have a job and just to support yourself. Like, not having money is pretty hard.
I'm in the heart of a Northern Territory community called Ngawiyu. It's about 3 hours' drive south of Darwin. The countryside is glorious, and that's because it's the middle of the wet season. So that means rain, it means sweat, it means hot, hot, hot. And most people have taken refuge under the shade of extremely large trees around town. In fact, just down the road, we've had one big group of people just finish a huge territory-style lunch, an open fire, embers, four or five kangaroo tails just roasting on the coals, and a big bucket load of damper as well.
Yeah, we can. Somebody here, me, flatland kind of.
Sitting around that fire is Miriam Rose Bowman. She's a Daly River elder and was the Northern Territory's first fully trained Indigenous teacher, becoming the principal of the local Catholic school here. Despite dedicating her life to education, she's now questioning the point of it.
Yeah, you know, when people come and ask us about how the education program is going in the community, sure, there are kids going to school, there's nothing here for them. And, you know, you ask yourself, what are we educating our kids for? Just to go on basic cards? We had a really excellent CDP program here, that's Community Employment Development Program.
And who ran that, do you know?
Community Government Council. And then when we amalgamated with the shires, everything, that they've taken everything. People were sacked, they took over our machineries, and there was nothing left. And then if there's anything happening now, it's just woodwork and like with if you're on unemployment jobs, looking for the dole. It's just doing things with wood or cutting grass. It's nothing job. There's no real jobs with real money.
The Work for the Dole scheme in remote areas is now known by the acronym RJCP, which stands for Remote Jobs and Communities Program. It began in 2013 with the aim of helping more Indigenous people into jobs. Program delivery in Daly River has been entirely taken over by the Darwin-based Ironbark Aboriginal Corporation after Ngawiyu's own Aboriginal Corporation went into special administration late last year. Whatever its problems or its possibilities, Dion has given RJCP the flick.
They do come after you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So how do you avoid them? You just...
hide.
You just hide.
Stay home and watch TV all day.
Do they get you to do anything interesting or worthwhile?
You're pretty much doing the same thing, like cutting grass, picking up rubbish, and it just gets pretty bored.
You don't see a lot of value in it?
No, I don't really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Already cut up.
The Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scullion plans to roll out RJCP changes in July that would force the unemployed in remote communities to work up to 25 hours a week. He says at the moment they're required to do up to 20 hours a week of work-like activities, and the increase is about exposing job seekers to more work-like requirements. Dion thinks it's a good idea, if it's done properly.
You just keep people opportunity, or young people, sort of sitting around doing nothing all day.
But you didn't like the RJCP as it is now, and that's less hours, so you're hoping, I assume, that they would give you proper work to do.
Yeah, proper work to do. Different jobs, instead of having to do the same thing every day.
But if it's just cutting grass or sitting around?
I'll probably go to one day, and then the next I'll probably stay home.
You gotta go like shop room.
My name's Robert Ostrell. I work at the local clinic here.
If someone were to come and ask you about jobs in Daly River, what would you say?
I'll say, well, it's not a very good place to get a job, really, because you know, they got activities here, but then they do training, and that's what they're training up for. You know, there's no job, so why do they do training?
The 19-year-old Letitia Maranja is busy juggling a double degree down at Flinders University and wants to eventually come back home to teach. How do you compare to all your friends, the teenagers around here in Nauyoo?
Well, I don't like to judge myself as someone who's better than everyone else, because at the end of the day, we're all the same. We've come from the same backgrounds. We've had, you know, same experiences growing up. Half my friends now, they're like all alcoholics, smokers, drug addicts and all that stuff. I don't get involved in that much of their personal lives because I'm busy, you know, at uni, coming back home to visit family and stuff, so yeah.
You say that it's hard to get a job. How badly does that affect the people who are your age that you see?
It affects them enormously, because they get bored, they start, you know, trying to self-harm themselves, they go drinking, cause trouble. Whereas if they do have a job, then hopefully that'll keep them away from the alcohol and stuff.
We have to go forward, but we've got to be given the opportunity to be able to say to the government in what the needs are here.
There is a change coming, which is people having to work for 25 hours a week as part of RJCP. Do you see that as having much value?
Some people are saying that that's punishment jobs. The people weren't given the opportunity to sit in and talk in how they should deliver this. Well, another example of things from top down.
That was Miriam Rose Bowman, a Daly River elder and the Northern Territory's first fully trained Indigenous teacher, ending that report by ABC Darwin reporter Alyssa Betts. Ian Trust is the executive chair of the Woonam Foundation, based in the East Kimberley in Western Australia. The Woonam Foundation is an Aboriginal development organisation that aims to drive long-term socioeconomic change for Aboriginal people. Ian Trust, welcome to RN Drive.
Yes, so how are you, Tricia?
I'm well. Now, the Woonam Foundation works with people in the Kimberley region to get people into employment and to improve education outcomes. You have a workforce development centre. Give us an idea of some of the challenges you face in the region with crippling rates of unemployment.
Well, I suppose the main one is, the number of jobs that are available, people living in remote areas, you know, lack of transport. Some of the people we have, of course, don't have a work ethic. And so all those things combined means that we have a lot of difficulty getting more people into jobs that we would like. But on the other hand, I mean, in Kununurra itself, there are a fair amount of opportunities, especially in the things like areas farming, the tourism industry, service industries and so on. So there are sort of opportunities as well, but we do have a few challenges.
What are the challenges specifically? I mean, I've visited Aboriginal communities over a long period of time, and the employment gap is actually getting worse, not better. Does that surprise you? Is that something that you thought would have improved by now?
I would have hoped it would have improved. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that it's getting bigger. When you're going to very fairly remote areas like there is in the East Kimberley, there aren't very many job opportunities around. So for a lot of the Aboriginal people to take up opportunities, they do need to actually move somewhere where there are jobs. I mean, I think that there needs to be a more concerted effort in trying to get people into jobs, because I think it's really the key in terms of breaking the, you know, this poverty cycle that many families are trapped in for two or three generations. And until we actually can actually do that, I think we're going to be having a battle on our hands for many years to come.
So what sort of things do communities need to face up to? You've been pretty radical in your approach. You've argued, for instance, that some of the recommendations of the Forest Review, which has been handed to the government to consider changing employment programs for Aboriginal Australia, should be considered. Lots of other Aboriginal groups and other Aboriginal leaders don't feel as warmly as you do towards that report. What is it about that report and its recommendations that you think could help deal with crippling rates of unemployment?
Well, I think the basic thing is that we've got to stop doing what we've done for the last 40 years in terms of wanting to break the cycle of poverty with our people, especially in areas of jobs, better quality education and so on. We've got to start doing things differently, and one of those things is jobs. And, you know, the opportunities are mainly where the population centres are. A lot of our people don't live there. So you can't sort of expect, you know, to be able to have sort of enjoy opportunities or better lifestyle in areas where there's no jobs there. Obviously, I think people should be able to live in a good house and so on. But in terms of actual jobs, you're going to have to sort of go to areas where there are jobs. They can sort of orbit back and forth to their communities. They don't have to sort of move out forever. They're the decision that we're going to have to take.
One of the policies that the government has now definitely said it will go forward with is this policy to put unemployed people in Aboriginal communities on full-time work for the dole, and that's going to start in July this year. What are your views about whether that's a good idea?
Well, I think it depends on what they're doing. I mean, I think that if they're doing sort of good things for the community in terms of, you know, sort of making the community a better place to live with, I don't see any issues with it at all.
Does it concern you, though, that it might be sort of an endless road for some of those people, work for the dole potentially forever, rather than real long-term sustainable jobs where people are earning an income which is higher than welfare?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the ideal. I mean, we want people on, you know, full-time sustainable jobs that sort of breaks that cycle of poverty. And so working for the dole is, you know, is not a sort of form of CDP, really. I don't think that's a positive at all. But if it's a transition process where you're skilling up people to actually where they get real skills, then be able to, in that sort of work environment, then be able to go on to a real job and be able to get a proper income, well, then, you know, it's a stepping stone that probably you need to have in place.
I wonder if I can ask you on a really personal level. You live in the Kimberley. You see this every day in front of you. Do you ever see a day where it will end, where unemployment will not be at these high levels, where there will be people, at least one adult in the home, with a full job that's not subsidised by the government? Because many Aboriginal people feel like they're living in conditions that are very bleak.
We've got to be positive about these things. I mean, the Aboriginal people living in the Kimberley, they have lots of abilities and lots of talents that haven't been sort of tapped yet by anyone. And you've got to be very strategic at how we sort of break the cycle of dependency. And I think that, you know, obviously a government's got a lot of, they've got a big role to play here in terms of providing opportunities, providing the infrastructure, building capacity of organisations such as mine to be able to help people to break the cycle of despair. But I think that I mean, there's been a silent revolution going on as it is with people taking up job opportunities in the mining industry, which has largely gone sort of unnoticed. But I think that those people taking up those opportunities have come from a lot of families who have been long-time welfare dependent. So they've already proven that given the opportunity, many of our people will stand up and be counted with this. So I think that we've just got to be given the opportunity.
Ian Truss, thank you so much for joining me on RN Drive.
Thank you.
And that was Ian Truss, the Executive Chair of the Woonan Foundation, based in the Kimberley in Western Australia, talking about jobs and economic development. But to even get to the position where Indigenous Australians can get the jobs, they first need access to a decent education system. Truancy is a huge problem in many Indigenous communities, and the Abbott government has been trying to tackle it. But is it enough, and is the way that they're trying to tackle it the way to go forward? Joining me now on the phone from Perth is Chris Sara. He's the chairman of the Stronger, Smarter Institute, which has worked with 450 schools around the country to improve education outcomes for Indigenous children. And we're also joined by Tanya Major. She's the founder and the chair of the Major Impact Foundation, which runs a number of education programs for people in remote communities. The organisation also targets disadvantaged youth and adults that want to re-engage with education and mentors women. Welcome to you both to RN Drive.
Thanks, Patricia.
Chris, very nice to be with you. Hi.
Lovely. Chris, I'll come to you first. From your experience, what is the biggest thing stopping Indigenous people from getting a decent education that sets them up for the future, that gets them these decent jobs or any job at all in some cases?
Well, it's the, the outset, the assumption that they're not worthy of a quality education, and that's been reflected in lots of places over many decades. Now, as Indigenous people, there are clear examples of where we've demanded good quality education and access to good education as early as 1900s. But we haven't ever had a time when I think governments of any persuasion has seen Indigenous communities, whether they're remote or urban or metro communities, worthy of delivering the kind of education that's going to enable the pursuit of excellence for them.
Truancy has been a huge issue in Indigenous communities, and it's actually the central policy focus of the Abbott government. Truancy is entirely, the anti-truancy scheme is entirely the way that they're viewing this issue of school attendance and getting kids educated. I believe that they've asked you to give them advice on how to get kids to school. What advice have you given them, Chris Zara?
Well, I think even if you look at the kind of the terminology around that sort of truancy sort of paradigm, is a very kind of deficit sort of thinking paradigm. It says little about the pursuit of excellence. It says little about the quality of schooling. And so I've tried to, and you know, I have a good hearing with the Minister Nigel Scully, and he gets what we're talking about. And he understands very well that, you know, in schools, and particularly remote schools, where you've got an exceptional principal with good, strong leadership, who's insisting that the quality of teaching in his or her classrooms are as good as any you'll see in the country. These are the sort of schools that you'll turn up to. And I think, you know, as much as we can shift away from the kind of truancy paradigm and the discussion in such a harsh and kind of negative and sort of draconian sort of context, and shift to it being a conversation about the extent of effective engagement of schools and communities and positive relationships, then we can make a shift.
Tanya Major, let me bring you into the conversation. You've been a very fierce defender of kids in education and pushing this agenda of getting kids into education. What do you think's wrong with the system as it functions?
Oh, I think there's a lot of things wrong with this system. First, it's dominated by men. And second, we need more women in there. Look, I couldn't agree anymore with Dr. Chris. I mean, Dr. Chris is right on all accounts. We need quality teachers in community. We also need these teachers to engage a lot more with parents and people in remote communities. I mean, I am an example of what is possible, providing that the services are in place and the support structure and the mentoring, and that these kids are engaged. And he's right. And I find I've spoken to a few teachers and they all blame it down to behaviour. And I said, well, have you ever thought about engagement? Mm. How are we going to really engage these kids and keep these kids at school, rather than saying that we have a chronic truancy problem here in the community? And so what I've been working on over the last nearly 5 years is working with mothers and getting mothers engaged in their own education, so they too can be mentors for children.
Yeah, that's the best approach, isn't it? And that's what all the evidence shows, doesn't it, Chris Zara, that it actually comes from the home. So unless you equip the parents, you're not going to get the outcomes.
Yeah, but I mean, I sit in this conversation as a very proud Aboriginal man, but also I'm very proud of my profession. And I've got to say this, it's my very strong belief that today's education workforce does have the capacity to attend to the challenges that sit in front of us when it comes to Aboriginal education. If we can adjust the kind of way of thinking, and yes, there are lots of things that are wrong with the system and the current way that we do things, but there are a lot of things that are really great and a lot of things that we can build upon. And it's not like a hopeless case here. And we've proven that in the schools that we've worked with at the Stronger Smarter Institute over the last 10 years, that with an adjustment of the hearts and minds of educators, and getting them to engage Aboriginal children as exceptional young men and women, but we really can make a difference. So it's not all doom and gloom here.
On RN Drive, you're listening to our Behind the Gap series, and today we're talking about education and work. Chris Zara, the chairman of the Stronger Smarter Institute, is one of my guests, and he's joined also by Tanya Major, the founder and the chair of the Major Impact Foundation. Tanya, if I can come to you, Do you think truancy itself, I know Chris is concerned, and I take that on with the prism of the truancy discussion that, that has been constructed by the government and has been the way now we frame education, but do you think that's it's an issue that kids aren't turning up to school, that, that they can't even start getting an education because they're not going through the school gate or the school classroom doors in the morning?
Oh, look, that has definitely been an issue from when I was a remote kid, barefoot in the bush. The question remains, yeah, we might have 100% attendance in these schools, but why is it that the NAPLAN results are showing that these kids are at least 4 to 5 years behind their actual year level is the question. And it's all great that we have more kids at school, but there's a systematic failure in place where how are we going to make sure that these kids in these remote schools are going on to boarding school with the right set of skills at the right year level rather than being 3 to 4 years behind. And the big push around more bums on seats, yeah, it's a KPI government can tick off it. Great, they're doing this. But I think the question remains is where these kids actually have the skills to go on to year eight successfully and complete it.
Chris Sara, so the government's whole strategy is all about truancy. Is this a huge blunder in your view?
Oh, look, there are challenges for all of us, but when you structure it in that kind of truancy paradigm, it kind of implies that the bulk of the blame lies with parents and with communities. But if you structure it within the context of a school connectedness paradigm, then it shares the blame more appropriately, and that is it raises questions about the ability of educators to be well connected to families. Because after all, it's school teachers, school principals who are paid to be in the relationship. And with that comes a sense of incumbency that we as educators have to go out of our way to find out why kids are not coming. So if I'm a teacher and I've got six kids who are not turning up to my classroom consistently, then as an educator, I take that very personally because I want to be the best that I can be as an educator. I want to know why they're not turning up, and that's going to cause me to reflect and think, what is it that I need to change? And so I might get in the car and go and see those parents or see those kids and say, let's talk about this. You know, that's what your good quality educators will do, and that's where you get the best results.
Now, there's a report before the Abbott government at the moment, and it's understood that they've taken on many of its recommendations, and this is the Forrest report. It's largely about jobs and employment, but of course there's an education focus too. I spoke to Andrew Forrest yesterday. He's a mining magnate, but he's also become an Indigenous advisor to the government. Here's what he had to say.
I think the draconian part is paying vulnerable Australians pure cash, ticking your own conscience box and giving up on them. We need to go the extra mile for vulnerable Australians and those who are severely alcohol and drug addicted, those who look after communities where they see the highest rates of suicide anywhere in the world, let alone in Australia. They need to put the drug barons and in some ways also the publicans out of business.
And he's talking there about the healthy welfare card, which prohibits people from spending welfare on alcohol and other prohibited items. Chris Sara, what do you think of that approach?
Well, the kind of healthy welfare card or basics card, it seems like a same dollar, different haircut, is draconian. And, you know, I get why people think that it offers a solution. But, you know, from the outset, and Twiggy's right when he calls for a new, bold and innovative approach here, but a basics card is not a bold and new and innovative thing. These are things that have been happening in the last century where the government or the state controlled the income of Aboriginal people. And what's boggling about all of this is that the evaluation of this approach, the income management approach in the Northern Territory, said that it wasn't working. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. It says the evaluation data does not provide evidence of income management having improved the outcomes that it was intending to have an impact. Indeed, what it did was appear to have encouraged increasing dependence on the welfare system. And so I think if we're going to be bold and innovative then and do something that we haven't done before, then we have to embrace we have to acknowledge and honour the humanity of Aboriginal people in remote community and embrace them as people who have capacity and a sense of agency and pursue their ability to be exceptional in a modern world. Now, there is good reason to believe that Aboriginal people are exceptional, and we've proven this in all sorts of places, from remote communities, from urban and metropolitan communities, that we are exceptional people. And so if we want to be bold and innovative here and do something that we haven't done last century, let's engage us as exceptional.
Tanya Major, I'm going to give you the last word in this conversation. Do you think our schools, that actually are the kind of quality of education we're offering Indigenous kids, so I'm talking in the classroom, is substandard?
Well, look, from working in the community and on the ground, I'm into community development, social development. So I have seen that children struggle in remote communities because they don't speak English. And research has shown that teachers are not even aware of this. So until the education system itself, are able to understand the needs of an ESL student and change the teaching methodologies in the classroom, things will change. But getting back to Andrew Forrest's report about the basics card, my big challenge with that is, if you look at how much money is being spent around the Indigenous industry, how about we actually put the organisations who are getting taxpayers' dollars to fund us blackfellas on the ground to get a job, how about we put them on a management program and see how they're spending the money and making sure that they're actually, spending the money the way they should be rather than the way that keeps us unemployed.
That's a very strong point to end on, Tanya Major. It's if we put those organisations on a contract, they certainly haven't been delivering very well for many years. Chris and Tanya, thank you so much for joining us on RN Drive. We want to continue these conversations, and we'd certainly like to talk to you in the future about all these issues again. That was Chris Sara. He's the chairman of the Stronger Smarter Institute, which has worked with 450 schools around the country to improve education outcomes for Indigenous children. And Tanya Major, she's the founder and the chair of the Major Impact Foundation. And it runs a number of education programs for people in remote communities, also targeting women. And again, a big thanks to ABC Darwin journalist Alyssa Betts, who took a road trip for RN Drive. Yes, the pun is intended. I think it's hilarious. To Daly River to file us that on-the-ground report you heard earlier about how unemployment looks in a community, rather than just talking above it all, but how does it actually look in a community? Next week is our last Behind the Gap program. We will continue to cover Indigenous affairs, but it's the last one of our series, and we're going to be looking at justice. You're on RN Drive. It's 9 minutes to 7.